getting to their destination and return safely. Forgive us of our sins and be with Ken in the class and lesson this morning. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
If you would like to turn the New Testament to Matthew, the fifth chapter, Matthew 5, we're going to be looking at a few things in the Sermon on the Mount this morning. We've studied that recently in a number of different contexts, so I wanted to bring up something that, of course, when you get a chance like this to just teach a class, you sort of grab things that you've been interested in, that you've been studying as a good fodder for bringing out, and hopefully other people will be interested as well. Jesus, in his teaching, when he was working among the people, one of the things that we have to keep in mind as we try to analyze the things he was telling people and how he was teaching was that he was a Jew, he was living in a community of Jews, and he was teaching in a way that people would be able to listen to him and respect what he was saying. He was considered a rabbi. And I think that gives us just a little edge on understanding some of the things that he was trying to get across to people. And one of the things that he was trying to let the people know was that they really had not done a good job of following God's law like God wanted them to. Now, during his time, there were a lot of different teachings going on. One of the books you'll hear me refer to a lot, just because it's kind of a fun book to read, is the Mishnah, which is a compilation of teachings from around that time period. It was oral from the Babylonian captivity all the way through down to the time of Christ. It began to be compiled there. There were two major houses, other rabbis who had these teachings that were very famous, and you may have heard their names before. One of them was Hillel, and the other one was Shammai. And these two guys were about as different as you could be, and you could imagine. Shammai was the really conservative guy, okay? We would also, irascible, not easy to get along with, and in many cases, you know, a lot of people just didn't like it. But his teaching was pretty subtle. Hillel, on the other hand, was the charismatic, easygoing, everybody liked him kind of person. And was, on the other hand, a bit on the liberal side. And we'll see some of that as we go through and talk about these things. But the main reason I want to bring that up is sometimes you get an idea that everybody during the time of Christ agreed on everything. They didn't. They had all kinds of arguments and discussions and misunderstandings of what was going on. And I think if we understand that a little bit, it gives us a little bit of insight into today, it's really not that much different. People still have arguments, and the same kinds of problems that they had were still going on. So what I want to emphasize today is one of the three great teachings that came out of what they call the Great Assembly. The Great Assembly was the group of scholars that were put together primarily in the Babylonian captivity, but they draw their roots all the way from Moses. When Moses assigned the 70 to help him rule and whatnot, this kind of morphed into this thing called assembly, and by the time we get to Christ, what was it called? Anybody remember? The Sanhedrin, okay? And they were the governing body. They were the ones who put down these laws and everything. Well, they had three rules to guide them that came from the very beginning, from the very ancient days. The first rule was, be very deliberate in your judgment. That's a pretty good rule. That's a pretty good standing. What they really meant by that was, when you start to work with people or work with laws or work with things that are right and wrong, make sure you've got a basis in the law. That's what they really meant by being deliberate in your judgment. Was make sure that you're pulling whatever judgment you render as coming from God's law. The second one was to build a fence around the Torah. And we'll talk more about that in a minute. Build a fence around the Torah. What do you think that means? What do you think that means?
Protected?
Yes, okay, it's protected. But it's more protecting you. The Torah didn't need protection, but why do you put fences around something, typically? To keep people out was one thing, right? Okay, we put fences around like endangered plants and things, but the idea is keep the critters out, keep the animals out, that kind of stuff. You have a line that you're not supposed to cross. So if you think about it this way, if you're going to build a fence around the Torah, if you're going to build a fence around God's law, basically you want to establish boundaries that you don't want to cross. Now the idea is, if there's something that's wrong, and you know that that's wrong, then you ought to be able to back out some distance to something that's maybe not wrong, but you know that if you're going to cross that line, you're getting too close. The idea was, make sure that you're safe in following God's law. So it's not a bad principle to be able to say, I want to make sure that I'm following God's law, so I'm going to back up a little bit. There's some dangers in that. We'll talk about those in a minute. That was the second one. The third one was, make many disciples. And so the tradition of the rabbi's teaching to make disciples was very strong. So why was it that people would gather with Christ at occasions like the Sermon on the Mount to hear him talk? Well, they were doing that because that was part of the Jewish tradition. It was part of them wanting to hear, wanting to understand someone who could expound on the Torah. And isn't that what Jesus really taught from, was the old law? That's what he taught from. That was his basis for communication with people.
So when you see him say things, take a look at Matthew 17, Matthew 5, and we're going to begin in verse 17. He said, "Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law until all is accomplished." Now,
does it sound like there that he's fixing to teach them different things than what the law said? I'm going to overdo the law. No. We start with the basis of the law is the law. And I did not come to abolish the teachings that are in the law. He said I came to fulfill them, but he also came to uphold them, did he not? And that he lived a life that was in perfect harmony with the law, unlike everybody else that's ever lived, and like anybody in his time. So when we go on down in his teachings here, and he begins in verse 21, where he says, "You have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court, and whoever shall say to his brother, Raka, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court, and whoever shall say, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell." All right, those two verses. How many of you ever heard anybody say that Jesus was changing the old law? When they read that. You ever heard that? Yeah. Now, does that make sense of what we read two verses before? No. So, if Jesus isn't changing the old law, he says, "You have heard it said, but I say," what's he doing? Exactly. But, did they not understand that murder was wrong? You heard it said that the murder is wrong, right? Do you think there was any question to anybody about that? Here's the question, though. How do you keep from murdering somebody? What Jesus is doing here is perfect rabbinical teaching. He's showing them how to build the right fence around the Torah. Now, is he saying that being angry is a sin? It's important that we look at this one. This one is easier to understand. Let's get it all straight because it uses the same pattern multiple times. How do we know that it's not a sin to be angry? What's that? Well, he's not angry. That's a good one. What else? Paul, Ephesians. What does he say? Be angry and sin not. Do not let the sun go down upon your wrath. Can it turn into a sin if you're angry and hold a grudge and hold it too long? Yeah, all of those things. But just getting angry, there are times when it's righteous anger, there are times when we're angry and we realize I shouldn't be doing this and you have to back off, right? And so just being angry is a sin. So Jesus isn't saying that being angry is a sin here. The context that he's talking about is murder. So the next thing he says is, so if you're angry with your brother, then what's he saying? If you're angry with your brother, what's the words he used? say, "You fool," you're in danger of the hellfire, right? Now, does that mean that, once again, in danger of the hellfire, does that mean, oh, you sin, you're going to go to hell when you die? Where's the hellfire going to come? At what point is it that they cross the line? It's a progression. It's exactly what it is. So the first thing is you get mad. And if you recognize that you're mad, that's the first fence, right? And you go, whoa, I'm not supposed to be mad. Don't let the sun go down on your wrath. It's the same thing that Paul says. But you don't recognize it then. You're still mad. And what's the next progression after getting mad? Now I start calling them names and we get into an altercation, right? Now, boy, you're really getting too close to the line at that point. And if you don't back off, what's the next step? Somebody's going to go to hitting each other. And, you know, that never comes out well. They always talk about in school, you know, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, right? That means if somebody hits you, you can do that. Now, the idea there was, is what's it supposed to be? I mean, okay, they hit you and I hit them back. Then
even.
Even, right? Now, is that the way it ever went?
No.
Somebody hits me, what do? I hit a part, right? Now, because there was this differential, then what happens next? And yeah, they hit me harder, right? And it just escalates from there, and pretty soon somebody picks up a hammer or a rock or whatever it happens to be, and somebody's hurt. I think Jesus deliberately started with this one because they could understand this. This is pretty easy to see, isn't it? That we're building a fence. This is how you should look at God's laws, and that is to figure out what other things are appropriate for looking at and understand where that limit is and be able to back off from there. Now, did the Pharisees always understand how to draw those lines? You remember when Jesus and his disciples at one point, the Pharisees got after him because they didn't wash their hands. You ever wondered why they got after him because they didn't wash their hands? Now, okay, most of us know, okay, it was a tradition, it was something the Pharisees said they ought to do, and they had turned it into law. We'll talk more about that in a second. But that wasn't the whole thing. What we have to understand about that is why they wanted you to wash their hands. Why did the Pharisees want you to wash your hands before you ate? Okay. Partly. It actually is a really convoluted reason. You're going to love this one, okay? Now, in our day and age, it's easy. You know, you wash your hands before you eat because your hands are dirty, you want to get the germs off of them and whatnot. That had nothing to do with it. Okay, it wasn't a sanitary thing at all. Uncleanness had to do with it, but the idea was, do you remember when the priests offered sacrifices? What did they have to do before they went into the tabernacle or into the temple? They had to wash their hands, okay? And that was part of the cleanliness ritual before they could go in. And so the reasoning was this. We want to build a fence around the Torah. We want to be acceptable to God. The priests, we know, are acceptable to God. And they go in and they wash their hands, offer the sacrifices, and then they eat the sacrifices, right? So if we want to be acceptable to God, we're going to imitate the priests and wash our hands before we eat so that we have the same kind of cleanliness ritual that the priests have when they offer sacrifices and eat. Now, that sounds like interesting reasoning. Probably not something that you or I would come up with, but it sounds good. What's wrong with it?
Missing the point of why the priests.
Yeah, it misses the whole underlying point. Is that something that's built on the principles that were given to the priests? No, it's something that they made up. And then, after establishing that this was a cool thing to do, now what do they proceed to do? Now everybody's got to do it. It's a law, suddenly. If you don't do it, you're in trouble, right? They built a fence around the Torah, but it was a lousy fence. It wasn't one that belonged there. It had nothing to do with the actual not disobeying God's law, but had everything to do with them putting something in place to give the appearance of righteousness. And that was never what the law was all about. The law was never about any appearance of righteousness. The law was about being righteous. So, He covers it here with this example on murder, and it's pretty clear. And then the consequences of that are verse 23 and 24. So if we've drawn this rule that we're not supposed to get angry and we don't want people angry with us and that's how we're going to work along, then look what happens next. He says, if therefore you are presenting your offering at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled with your brother and then come and present your offering. Now here's where it kind of gets turned on its head in an interesting way, isn't it? Now remember, this is the same context. So, I've established that if I can keep from getting angry, if I can keep from calling names, if I can keep from escalating this, then we'll avoid this murder, which we know violates the Torah. So, I go to offer my offering, and I remember, who's got his hand? Now, how many of us would say, whose responsibility is it to make the first offering to get things straightened out? Who is it? The one who's been offended or the one who thinks that he's the offender? How many of you, they're the one that did something wrong. It's up to them to, take care of it, right? Well, is that what they're saying? Absolutely. This then says, if you remember something, now why would you do that? Because you don't want your brother to be angry with you. And this has nothing to do with self-defense and not wanting to get killed eventually. Okay? This has to do with making sure your brother doesn't violate the Torah. Right? And so it now becomes a two-way street. We've got this principle that we can look at to say, not only will it help me to watch out what's going on, but it'll allow me to help others. And if I know that there's anger, if I know that there's a problem there, if there's something I can do to help that, that becomes my responsibility because I want to help keep somebody else from violating the gospel. You see that? Okay. You use that one. Pretty straightforward. There wouldn't have been a lot of arguing about this. But now he starts to build on that principle with some things that were pretty controversial during his day. What's the next one that he says? Verse 27, you have heard it said that you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. You think adultery was as big a problem back then as it is now?
I got a clue for you. Human history, it's been a problem. There's never been a time in human history when that hasn't been a problem. We think we got it rampant today.
Yeah, I agree. And it's a problem. Always has been. So you got to work with it. Right? You got to deal with it. How do you understand it? Well, he's got a couple of things here he's going to deal with. Is this saying then, and look at the pattern, because he's using the same pattern, is he saying then that just looking at another woman makes you pretty, that's a sin now?
No.
Is he saying that if you lusting after a person, that is the same as having committed adultery? And you see, I've heard people trying to make that argument as well. You know, that, mental adultery or something like that. I'm sorry, that's not how Jesus understood it. That's not how Jesus was talking about it. That's not what's going on here. What's he saying?
You're on the first stage, the step towards.
Absolutely. You start looking and letting your eye waver, and that's the first step towards crossing the line. So how do you keep from crossing the line?
Don't do that.
Right? Back it up. If you recognize yourself having thoughts about somebody that aren't the right thoughts, then you need to do something about it. So he says, don't let your eye wander. Now somebody read the next two verses there. Again, consequences, just like on the other one. What's he say there? If your eye offends you, pluck it out. That really means like, oh man, I looked at somebody. Sorry, eye, there it goes. No.
What does he mean by that?
You've got to do something about it. Okay? This isn't just, should have done that.
Look again.
You've got to take control of your life. You've got to recognize these barriers. You've got to recognize these fences and understand when you're crossing them. Because if you don't see those, if you you don't live your life in a way that you understand when you're getting to a point where you can cross a line, then you're going to blunder across it and you're going to have the gall to be surprised. And I've talked to people who've gotten into these conditions of health and go, well, I don't know what happened. It's like, really? How can you not know what happened? This isn't something that just you accidentally do. You have to be careful. You have to draw these lines. So I think he's now hit one that's a little closer to home. How many of those people sitting in his feet and listening to the crowds there, do you think he actually committed murder or were contemplating committing murder? Probably not too many of them, right? Kind of frowned on by the Roman government. That's one of those pariah things. We talk about the great sins, you know, and we can talk about murdering people easily because not that many people do that. How many of them might have been involved in adultery? Yeah, starting to get a little closer to home in the crowd here, aren't we? Yeah, okay, that's a problem. So, he's addressed something that's getting a little closer, but he's shown them the same principles, how to draw a fence around the Torah. But notice this next one, verse 31. And it was said, whosoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of dismissal. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the cause of unchastity, makes her commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Now, what verse is he referencing there? If you've got a side margin, you probably can see it there on the side. What verse is he referencing when he says that? Anybody see it? Okay, that's one of the places, but Deuteronomy 24.1 is the specific one he's going after. Deuteronomy 24.1. Somebody turn over there and read that for me, please. Deuteronomy, the 24th chapter, and verse 1.
When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in her in his eyes, because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house.
Okay. So you can write a certificate of divorce for what reason? What does it say? He's found some uncleanness in her. Now, here's where we get to the houses of Hillel and Shammai. Shammai, the irascible dude, said, obviously, if you look at all of the other provisions in the old law, considering Malachi, where he says, I hate divorce, Genesis, where it was that marriage was enjoined by God, that what he means there is unchastity. Okay? That's what Shammai said. Now, how popular do you think that was as a rendering? Not very popular. Okay? Now, what do you think Hillel said? Yeah, he said, you know what? I don't like the girl. That's uncleanness. That's an unseemliness. Therefore, I can write her a divorce. You know, it's a burnt toast equivalent. Whatever reason. Now, how popular do you think Hillel was? Good dude. He's really popular. What's Jesus saying? He said, you have heard it said. And he quotes basically the old law. This is kind of a Septuagint rendition that Jesus quotes there. They had this discussion on what the right way about that one was. Was it anything, or was it just uncleanness? Was it, or was it immorality? What does Jesus clarify? What does he say? It's only one thing. And be much clearer. Divorce there was if your wife was unfaithful. Clarify. Now, he's just before that. Talk about how to remain there, right? So he's given them the defense. Now he's getting down here to this, and he's saying that you've heard people say, and here's the correct statement of it, a lot of you got it wrong. Here's the way it's always meant to be. Now, they would have taken this as, oh, okay, you think this was hard?
That's right. How common was it for the women to commit adultery? I mean, we always hear of the men commit adultery with marrying wives as rapists, but
yeah.
Then?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. those sites. And in fact, one of the most common problems back then that was difficult was that, especially among the class of men who business took them on traveling and whatnot, business trips back then, I mean, I think it's terrible when I'm gone 4 weeks to Korea. All right? 4 months was not an uncommon business trip back then. 6 months. And so people tended to stray a little bit. And if they did it discreetly and the person came back and nobody was any the wiser, they felt like they were just fine. So, yeah, it was a problem on both sides. It was a problem on both sides. Yeah, and if you look at some of the other teachings, they had taken some liberties that God never intended. And so he says, then why didn't Moses give him a writ of divorcement or certificate of divorcement? He said, because it was the hardness of your hearts. We can come back and look at that as another issue. But Jesus is pretty much just trying to clarify what it should have been from the beginning for them. And the nice thing about that is, once you've got a fairly clean line like that, is it fairly easy to figure out? And that's what he did with the murder, was he said, here's the clean line and here's the way to back off from it. Here's the problem with divorce, that if it starts with adultery, if adultery is the main reason for, or the only reason for a legitimate divorce, then how do you prevent adultery? Well, you work on that, you back off from that. So that's the progression he's trying to get them to understand, is let's not cross these lines. The rest of the whole marriage divorce thing, I don't want to get into a lot this morning because I want to get into these other things, but good question, we could talk about it another time. But you see the progress that he's trying to make here with how he's trying to draw these rules for them. And we see that the Pharisees weren't always good at doing these. Okay, so here we had an example where the Pharisees had made up some things based on what they thought God's law was. There was different people drawing different lines about what that meant, and Jesus had to clarify it for them. Similarly, in verse 33, he says, again, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. Now, you can go to Leviticus, and you can go to Exodus, there's any number of places where it says that if you vow something, what are you supposed to do? Keep your word. Now, here's what the Pharisees had done, and this is why Jesus wrote this. Jesus said, but I say to you, make no oath at all, either by the heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no, and anything else beyond these is of evil. Now, is he saying that anything else you say other than yes and no is a sin? Okay, got back up from there and that's not the way it's going. So why did he mention all of these things about the throne and the footstool and your head and all that kind of stuff?
They were using those to kind of erase some importance. You could say, just tell the truth, just be truthful, just be honest.
Exactly. This was another example of where some of the rabbis had drawn these fences. And they were going, okay, if you make a vow and you say, you know, that I swear by the throne, well, the throne's important, so you got to hold that one. But if you swear by your feet, well, then people should have caught the clue there that what you really meant was maybe. You know? So they had this whole hierarchy of things that helped to clarify, you know, where this line was of when you had to keep your word. Is that the right kind of fence to draw? No. What's Jesus say about it? Now, you see the progression here? Are there some fences we need to draw, some rules and regulations and some guidelines to our lives that we need to recognize that will help us keep from violating God's law? Yes. But can we draw lines that are nonsense? Yeah, these were bad ones because now they were trying to figure out how to use one of these principles of draw a fence to, in essence, violate the law. Right? Now, I go through all of that and look at these examples in that way because it really just shows you that humankind hasn't changed all that much. Right? when we study and we study God's Word, there are principles that are established that there's nothing else you can say. They're biblical principles. And then we have to decide how do we meet them, because sometimes they're a little tough. I'll take a common one in today's society. How about modesty? Does the Bible say that we're supposed to be modest? Did anybody really say what that means? Boy, if you listen to everybody in the world today, and everywhere from one end to the other, you're going to get all kinds of different reasons, descriptions, and whatnot. Do we need to draw some lines, folks? I think we do. And I can't tell you that the lines that I draw are necessarily going to be the same lines that you draw, but if you don't have any lines, I guarantee you, if you're trying to just figure out how close you can come before you step over, you're going to step over before you know it. That's the same things with murder or with adultery. It's a little clearer to see there because it's not a problem for most people. But you get into principles like honesty, and now it becomes a well, but everybody else, and it's a trend that, you know, I keep going on, but I think you see the principle. You see the point. Now, what's the bad thing you can do along those lines? Let's put it that. Yeah, okay. I have to be careful about what I consider to be my concept of modesty. If it doesn't agree with somebody else, we may have to work on that a little bit. But I can't just condemn them outright for that, as long as they can tell me that they have a principle and they decide what it is. Right? Not just, well, I can do anything I want and you can't condemn me. That's not the point. But I think there are certain points where I can go, ah, I'm sorry, I don't care what kind of line you want to draw, that was not right. Right? Well, that is one way of looking at it. But, you know, I'll take one. How about in some parts of the country, people want to wear a head cover? And to them, that's a line they want to draw. Well, I don't think that's the right line. Now, if I go worship with them, it's causing a problem. Now, will that mean that I'm supposed to have my wife wear it or not wear it? Because it causes a problem for them. See, that's not always the right basis. We have to be very careful with that basis. Am I supposed to be considerate of the feelings of others?
That's not what I'm talking about. I know that the problem is
to sin.
That head cover thing.
I understand.
I'm talking. I understand.
But I just want us to be really careful about what kind of basis we use there. I'm not totally disagreeing with you. We're saying we have to be very careful because it has to be something that we can apply in all circumstances. I'll take another one. And this was an interesting case. And I don't need a show of hands, but I suspect that there's a lot of people here, because I know it was in your homes around Christmas time, that put a Christmas tree, right? And I've been places where people didn't do that. Now, in South Florida, it's pretty much required to put a Christmas tree, okay? Because if you don't have a Christmas tree up, and you don't have a menorah, then you're an atheist. Okay, because you're either Jewish or Christian or atheist now, man, one or the other. And the way you can tell at Christmas time is whether you got a tree, a menorah, or a nothing. So, if you don't want to be thought of as an atheist, you're a Christmas tree. We had a good dear friend of mine that his parents were raised Catholic. And they made a really big to-do about a lot of the background of the Christmas tree and a lot of things like that. And he felt like, for his family, because of his background, he couldn't do it. But he was smart enough to recognize that that was him, that was his family, that was his line, and he didn't have a problem if other people wanted to, provided they understood that they weren't worshiping some pagan thing, right? How many of you actually had a Christmas tree up and think of wherever it came from as some pagan ritual or whatever? That's just not what we do, right? Okay, we're drawing a line. I don't think we have too many angels hanging on our Christmas tree. The only one was one that my kids did at school. I had a picture on the end of the evening when Aaron brought it home and handed it to us like this. Aaron, what's wrong with it? We know you use this. We're like, what's wrong with it? He goes, it's religious. You know, the line. Benjamin, when he was in, we put him in a religiously associated kindergarten because it was only a half day program and it was right at the end of our street. We knew the people there, all of our kids kind of gone there kind of thing. And my wife was going up close to the Christmas time, and they had, you know, their little Christmas place and things. My kids just didn't participate in that. And of course, when they had asked Benjamin to be Joseph, the first thing he did was he came home crying. And they're like, why? What's wrong? He goes, oh, you want to be sold into slavery. Wrong Joseph, okay? So my wife went up and talked to the teachers again, you know, they knew us pretty well. It was, you know, and his whole point was, we don't believe in Jesus. Like, the principal was standing there with my wife at the time, and the teacher, who luckily had our other kids, who said, wait, that's not what I'm saying. You see what I'm saying there? There's just so many things around that, and different people have different ideas and whatnot. We have to be careful about how we draw lines. But do we need to draw some lines? I think even there, we need to draw some lines. We need to be careful about what these things mean in the world and what our part is. And be sure that we understand the basis for what we believe. Because part of the problem that the Jews had in building their fences around the Torah was the appearance of righteousness. That's not what it's all about. That's not what Jesus was teaching. He was not teaching to have the appearance of righteousness. He was teaching to be righteous. Okay. Any questions, comments? We're just about out of time. That was the main part that I wanted.
I guess I just think of the head covering. You know, I've never been in such a situation, but I've had people come and stuff, and I've always kind of wondered if I went to a congregation where they all wore it, would I? Because if it's nothing to me, but then if I don't, the person behind me is going to be sitting behind me, kind of
looking down on me. Precisely. And my wife and I had talked about it at the time when we were thinking about not very long, moving to a place in Alabama. And it was like, okay, what will we do? And we finally decided that it didn't hurt anything. I don't think it's necessary, but it doesn't hurt.
It's not violating my conscience.
Right. But there are plenty of other things today. And there are rules and lines that have been drawn that have split congregations, that have divided families, that have caused no end of trouble. That if you really boil down to it, it's somebody has decided that what's righteous for them ought to be righteous for everybody. And in many cases, it boils down to an appearance of righteousness and not righteousness itself. Now, there's plenty of other ones. Plenty of other places where when we look at it, we've got to stand firm. It's not always easy to know that. It's why you have to study. You have to work.
I could hear everything Darcy said, but I was thinking that there's a good balance because while at one point you want maybe something might not bother me, then I know it might bother somebody else. And that understanding your conscience if they felt it's actually a sin versus if this is just something that they're holding to. I think one of the reasons Christ with the hand washing, he very easily could have done that. But in a sense, it was also showing them that we're not going to cater to man's ideas of righteousness. It's God that matters.
Right.
And so there's got to be a certain, that I just don't do something to pacify somebody because if that's exalting, or I don't want to say exalting, but basically you just kind of let that keep going.
Yeah, and there's two examples there that are very interesting along that line, because we do have Jesus and his disciples who didn't wash their hands, and yet you have Paul, who went through ceremony of some vows in the temple. Why did he do that? Paul knew that that wasn't necessary anymore. What did Paul say? He said, I became all things to all people, that to all I might teach some. So there are accommodations that we can make so that people will view us in a favorable light. But it's kind of like Fiddler on the Roof. You know, there's a certain point you can bend to, and then you're going to break if you try, if you keep going down that line.
Every time I read the books concerning nature, yes, yes, or no, no, it brings back some memories. I had a staff that worked for me many years ago when I was in the military, and we would have our staff meetings, and one of the rules I had was when we ask a question that needs a yes or a no, you're not allowed to answer unless you can first say yes or no, and then back it up.
Yeah.
If you're unable to say yes or no, you're not allowed to respond. And it used to just tear some. I thought I wanted to know yes or no, and then back it up. And everybody would listen.
I can work for you. I always have to explain this.
Yeah, politicians the same way, particularly in debates. I would think 9 times out of 10, when a question would be asked that was specifically asked for yes or no, you'd never hear that yes or no.
Yeah.
It's always, you know.
Oh, he'd be around. Spin. And sometimes there's good reason for it. But the main thing Jesus is wanting here, to be real clear about it, is if you say you're going to do something, you do it. If you say you're not going to do something, don't do it, right? I mean, his real emphasis is keep your word and don't try to weasel out things. That's the tough part, right? Because it's really easy to just tell people yes. Go.
Now, the elders have a role in this when it gets to that level in making some decisions about lines. And one church may draw a line a little different place than another. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad. It means that it's their preference or choice. Mm-hmm. Unless that there's a real scriptural tie.
I agree. And I think one of the things that we have to understand from this is that some of these lines, we have to recognize that there's going to be differences. And that's part of what we have to work on. And if we do, it should be more of a discussion about those differences and why and what are the underlying reasons, and hopefully be able to do that in a civil manner rather than people deciding that, you know, my wall is better than your wall and we're going to throw rocks at each other until we can break down one of the other walls, which is the way we tend to approach things, right?
I was just going to say, you're exactly right. You know, just think even culturally, you know, back then they accepted there were cultural lines. And even though we're under the new dispensation, they still popped up with some of the Jewish traditions. You know, if some of you came and worshipped under a tree with us with some of our African brethren, you might be quite horrified at the actions that they do in a worship. It's not something that's black and white in scripture, but it's a cultural thing.
Yes.
And but you might, well, this is not how we do it, and you might take offense, but it's a cultural thing as well.
Yeah, traveling around the world and visiting with Christians in different places, different cultures, will do an awful lot to teach you that there's more than one way to follow the scriptures and be faithful to God. And that's a lesson I think sometimes we, no matter where, I mean, we're bad in the U.S. about it, but I've seen it in other places too, that there's an enclave that says this is the way it's done. And that if that's not the way you do it, something's wrong. Well, it may not be comfortable. And I'll probably admit, I've been in some places where I was uncomfortable with some things that went on, but I couldn't say it wrong. It just wasn't what I was used to.
The Jews would have been uncomfortable eating some of the meat.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I think a lot of the Jews, that's a good point there. There came a point in time when Peter said it's all right, right? I mean, when Peter saw it's all right. There's probably a lot of Jews that said, well, it may be all right for you, but I've always lived my life this way. I don't have to. Right? Would it have been wrong for them to draw a line and say, I just don't want to do that? No. No. I mean, I think it was perfectly all right to eat meat. They did it in the Old Testament. God said, Peter, rise, go eat. But one of you guys wants to be vegetarian?
That
don't tell me I got to be vegetarian, right? I like my vegetarian pizza with sausage and hamburger on it. I mean, thousand pigs are vegetarian, so.
I guess to me, just the big thing is having to travel. It's whether you're visiting or you're going to try and become
a part
of that congregation, you know?
Sure.
Makes a huge.
And that's part of what you have to understand, is if you're going to become part of a place, you have to be willing to become part of the culture. Okay.